Good evening. At this time, Mel, K2KEY, and Dick, K2RIW, start a thing called the TechNet.
What is the TechNet?
It's a gathering of the clans. Guys get together Sunday night, 8 o'clock, sometimes till midnight, and they discuss ham radio fairly seriously. They help each other. They give each other advice, information, on how to get the best performance out of their antennas, their feed lines, their transmitters, their receivers. We discuss the 26. We discuss the 26 different kinds of ham radio, and we discuss a whole lot of other subjects that usually are of interest to ham radio operators. Ham radio operators are curious people, but they become curious about quite a few things, usually involved with electronics, wireless, computers, and combinations thereof. We sometimes get into high-definition television, and that's appropriate, too, because a significant number of ham radio operators have, over the years, used slow-scan and fast-scan television as one of the 26 modes that they enjoy. There are groups, for instance, on Long Island, among other places, that do fast-scan television. Some of those guys have got the equivalent of a studio where they can switch from camera A to camera B and zoom and automatic control and repeaters for television and whatever. This gives you a little bit of a hint. Most of the subjects that we discuss on the ham, on the TechNet, are subjects that you guys bring. The questions that you bring usually become the subject of discussion for that particular evening. Once in a blue moon, Mel will prepare something like a conversation on the subject, or a lecture, mini-lecture, let's call it, on the subject of how decibels work, or how the Smith chart works, or how transmission lines work. I get into mini-lectures from time to time on Yagi antennas and properly feeding the driven element of a Yagi antenna and how to get a perfect impedance match to a dipole and so on. These are some of my favorite subjects. There's a lot to learn on the subject. The schools that teach radio and wireless only teach a little bit of the information, unfortunately. A person becomes skilled in this art and science by
repeater. Time out.
A person becomes skilled in this art, radio, wireless, by having lots of years of experience, hands-on experience. You really want a person who understands radio. Most likely you're going to be forced many times to be hiring a ham radio operator. These are the people who have the drive, the interest, the experience. They really touched radio, touched antennas, made them work, found out what doesn't work. The schools only do a partial job of that. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters. Try to remember to give us your name. And follow that by the word yes or no, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Do we have any check-ins tonight? Please give me your call letters and name and that yes or no at this time. KQRIW listening.
Intuio, Rich, and no questions at this time.
And just monitoring the frequency.
Okay, we have both Rich and Eugene, and I think they're both with a no. Rich said no, and Eugene says just monitoring. Do we have anyone else to check in? Give me your call letter's name and the yes or no at this time.
Alpha Charlie.
Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta, John. Any follow-up from last week?
Oh, yeah, John. We'd like to hear from you. I heard Alpha Delta 2 Delta something. Extremely weak signal. And if I listen on the input, maybe I'll hear you a little bit better. Whoever that person is going to have to do something to increase his power into this particular repeater. If he's on a handy talkie, he's going to have to move to another location. If he's at home, he may have to aim his antenna a little bit differently, increase his power or whatever. The Alpha Delta 2 Delta question mark station. Want to try one more time? I'll listen on both the input and the output.
Alpha Charlie 2, Alpha Echo. First name is Joe, and yes, I do have a question. Sorry about that, gentlemen. I am on NHT.
Okay, Joe, a hell of a lot better that time. Alpha Charlie 2, Alpha Echo, was that? Did I have that correct, Joe?
Yes, sir. That's it. That's correct. Alpha Charlie 2, Alpha Echo.
Okay, a lot better that time. Alrighty. We got John and Joe and Eugene and Rich. Anyone else would like to check in? Give me your call letters, name, and the yes or no at this time.
KC2, UPP, Mike, no.
Good evening all. K2KEY just made it home.
WO2N, Bernie, no.
KC2DOH, Chris, no.
Okay, we picked up Chris, Bernie, Mike, Mel, approximately in that order. So far, the only people with yeses are Joe and John. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name at this time, and the yes or no.
H4YY Joe. No question. I don't know if you know, but you can hear me on this HD.
We're hearing you quite well, Joe. And I hope you will have some questions, because some of your questions are the very interesting ones. Particularly the one last week about the noise created by a chain link fence in the very near vicinity of a repeater system. A classic case that NASA has studied, and we amateur radio operators have done very little with that. You're at the leading edge of that particular state of the art there, Joe. Okay, one last call. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name at this time. And if you guys want, we can discuss the latest issue of QST Magazine, the latest issue of Scientific American, the latest things that are discussed by NASA Select Television or NASA in general. Paul, if he signs in, we'll be giving us that information. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters, name, and yes or no right now.
KC2MDP, Steve, no questions at this time, Dick.
Okay, Steve, with a no. The first person with a real question. Robert Peter, give me the full call again and the yes or no and the name, sir. Somebody ending in Robert Peter. I doubled with you by mistake. Give me the full call, yes or no, and the name. Okay, maybe I heard that one wrong. Joe, looks like you're the first person with a real question. Alpha Charlie 2, Alpha Echo. Where are you located, Joe? And go right ahead. K2LIW. My name is Dick.
Well, good evening, first of all. How's everybody doing this evening? Actually, my intent is pretty much based on antennas, and I heard that, you know, you're pretty much affluent with antennas. I'm in the process of building one of my own, and I'm just waiting on a toroid core. The only problem is I'm on a very high building, and I do have one good ground source up there, but I'm running into a problem with finding what to use for radio for the antenna and where and how to mount them up there when there really is no place. And that's really basically my question. AC2AE, I'm sorry, I forgot. I'm very new at this, and I forgot to call back to you.
Perfectly all right, Joe. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. Along with Mel, K2KEY, for lots of years, we've been running the TechNet. I've been here since 1982. Mel's a Johnny come lately. He's only been around for 4 or 5 years. I have some fun with him along these lines. Good set of questions, Joe. Do I have the name right? Yes, I think I do. The word ground to an antenna has a number of very different meanings than it does to a person who is doing, let's say, household wiring. There are three reasons why you and I would like a ground on our antennas, Joe. The first and most important reason is human safety. If the antenna itself is independently grounded to Mother Earth, then most likely no error can occur which will put high voltage on that antenna. If, for instance, the antenna by mistake came in contact with a power line that's supplying AC power to the house, and if the antenna is grounded, Hopefully the power line coming in contact will draw a high current, a fuse will be blown, the circuit will be disconnected, and all's well. Without that ground, the antenna could be hot, a person could go over there and touch the antenna, and might be in trouble. So human safety is reason number one. Reason number two that we ground our antenna is for lightning protection. If a lightning bolt on a high building happens to hit an antenna, it's a lot more rare event than you may think, Joe. If the antenna is well grounded, hopefully the current from the lightning bolt gets conducted to Mother Earth, doesn't get a chance to crawl down that cable, and possibly do damage to your radio. And by the way, even a radio that has been exposed to a lightning burst, a lightning bolt, most of the time, the front-end transistor might become damaged, but most of the radio will survive, and the repair for that is nowhere near as bad as you think 90-some-odd percent of the time. The third reason that we do grounding of an antenna is that in a few occasions, the antenna performs a little bit better and maybe creates a little bit less television interference. This is a controversial area. There's lots of guys who think that the only way to get rid of television interference is to grab a repeater.
Time out.
There are lots of guys who think the only way to get rid of television interference is to ground the antenna better. Or if something is not proper about the antenna so that current is flowing down the outside of the transmission line and you end up with RF energy in the shack and maybe your D104 microphone bites you on the lip when you come near it as you're talking, that's an undesirable situation which would be aided by grounding of the antenna, aided by grounded of the antenna, but that just gets rid of a symptom. It doesn't really get rid of the original cause. RF energy in a shack is usually due to a connector that's not properly installed or an antenna that's not working correctly. Now let me show you what the antenna really does with reference to ground. If I was mounting my quarter wave ground plane antenna, vertical ground plane antenna, in my backyard, I could choose to put a grounding rod in the ground as one of the terminals to the antenna, and the shield of the coax cable would go there, and the center conductor goes to the quarter wave vertical radiator. I could set up my ground plane antenna that way, and I would have some performance, but I would have marginal performance because RF energy in the vicinity of earthen material, looks at that material as a dummy load, a distributed volumetric dummy load, and a substantial amount of the RF energy would be absorbed by the ground. You may not see any standing wave ratio in the antenna. Their instrumentation in the shack will tell you everything's working correctly, and when you talk to people, you'll find out you're not very loud and the antenna is not very efficient. You could set it up that way, and the ground in that manner would work, but it wouldn't give you high performance. Let me drop. Every antenna requires the equivalent of a counterpoise. Counterpoise, ground plane radials, or the equivalent. In the case of a full symmetric half-wave dipole, you could say the left-hand side of the dipole is the counterpoise for the right-hand side. When the antenna is performing, what really happens is that the RF energy flows down your transmission line, goes into the antenna, and we want to believe the RF energy jumps into space. It doesn't do that. The RF energy, only a small amount of it goes into space on the first pass down the half-wave dipole wire. The energy is going to bounce back and forth many times before the energy is finally radiated. You and I call that resonance when you set up the antenna to be the right length so that all those bounces stay co-phase, they stay in step with each other. So on each cycle of the RF energy, your transmission line is acting like a pump. It's pushing electrons. It's pushing electrons from the left side of the dipole to the right side of the dipole on the first half of the cycle. On the second half of the cycle, during the negative voltage, it's drawing the electrons from the right-hand side and shoving them back to the left-hand side. They're bouncing back and forth, and the transmission line is pushing them. Very similar to what happens when your child is on a swing, and you push the child at the appropriate time at the bottom of each swing. The transmission line is doing that. The half-wave dipole is its own counterpoise, and it allows it to do that. In the case of a half-wave dipole, it really is a quarter-wave ground plane antenna to the right, and the quarter-wave ground plane antenna to the left, and you just happen
happened not to put the sheet of metal in the middle that acts as the ground plane radio. In the case of a quarter wave ground plane antenna, let me drop one more time. You're now drawing electrons from those grounding rods, those quarter wave ground plane rods, the counterpoise as it's called. You're drawing electrons from those and putting them into the radiator on the first hand cycle and then bringing them back. The ground plane radials try to act like a sheet of metal, which is a mirror image, so that there's a real quarter wave radiator above the ground and a mirror of image of one below the ground. And if this is the best of all worlds, you'd like to have 32 of those radials, and you would develop a near 100% efficiency of the antenna. And if you only put down 3, 4, or 5 of those radios, you get a lot of performance, but some of the RF energy sees the spaces between those, sees the Earth, and gives you some loss. In the case of a ground plane radial system, quarter wave ground plane radial system, which is high above the Earth, that's an advantage. Doesn't have to be near the Earth. And in that particular case, a smaller number of ground plane radials can give you a very good performance, and it doesn't have to be a local ground, radio-wise. For safety reasons, for lightning protection reasons, yes, to have a good ground on the antenna definitely helps. But it's not mandatory. You'll get good performance without it. Most people set up a halfway dipole with no real grounding. Sometimes they will ground the transmission line as it enters the shack, but the antenna itself is a thoroughly symmetric floating antenna, and it behaves beautifully well under those conditions. So the word ground, and the way you can read articles about that ground, Joe, will lead you to believe the antenna ain't going to work without the ground. Not true. It can work beautifully without a ground. And in the case of, let me drop, what some guys do on a high apartment building is they'll use a spiral wound radiator and make it electronically a half wave long instead of a quarter wave long, in which case they're feeding one end of a half-wave dipole where the impedance is 1,000 ohms instead of 35 ohms, as it would be if you only fed a quarter wave. And they use nothing for local radio grounding but the metal railing that's on the balcony, and they set this antenna up on the balcony, and they get very high performance. And the metal railing itself could be thoroughly floating, ungrounded, just a little bit of local ground plane, so to speak. And in the case of a half-wave resonator, that works very well. So don't lose a whole lot of sleep about not being able to find the ground. Do a series of experiments of what is the standing wave ratio, how well does the antenna work, are you getting RF energy in the shack, do people hear you well, does it hit resonance, do you have to do a whole lot of tuning of your antenna tuner. These are some of the things you'd like to know about. You may not understand all of those yet if you're a newer ham, and that's perfectly all right. Come back to the TechNet as many times as you like. Ask the questions. There's a group of people here who will try very hard to help you, and we'll help each other, if you know what I mean, Joe. You probably have some further questions on what you've heard. AC2, Alpha Echo, K2LIW, my name is Dick.
K2RIW, AC280. Yeah, well, actually, you've answered a lot of questions for me and given me, sprung up a whole bunch of new ideas. And I think I'm going to go with the many radios. That's what I was planning from the beginning, as well as still ground radios in the source that I have up there. One other question before I should go. Would it be advisable to run a rod into the ground and run a 100-something-foot copper wire up to the top of the building? Would that be better or not so much?
There's sort of a yes and a no to that one, Joe. Assuming you've got a real good ground rod into Mother Earth down below, and you've got a wooden building running a, let me pick a number, 8-gauge piece of wire 100 feet up the side of the building to your antenna, to the grounding system, for human protection purposes, that's number one for grounding, and for lightning protection purposes, it would help a lot. For radio reasons, that ground will make very little difference, because it's a long distance away, and that 100 feet of wire is one great big inductor. So the antenna itself will not view that as a ground radio-wise. If the building has any metal in it anywhere, like for instance a standpipe or a vent, a sewer system vent that comes out of the top of the building, that can be an extremely good local ground. If the metal girders of the building are at all accessible to you anywhere near the roof, that's a much better local ground. The frame, if your eyes looked at the building as if it was transparent and you could see the metal girders of your building, assume it's got metal girders for support, that's a great big monkey cage, so to speak, monkey bars, three-dimensional object, a space frame, so to speak, and the grounding of that is essentially automatic, dictated by Con Ed and LUCO and local New York City fire laws and whatever. So any local grounding you can pick up with the girders of the building is going to be radio-wise and human safety-wise a few times better than that wire you run all the way down the side. So you'd only have to run that wire all the way down the side of the building if it's a completely wooden building and nothing locally is grounded. Well, I guarantee there is a conduit pipe where your power wiring goes through. You've got water pipes. You've got the girders of the building. All of these things are very well grounded. Your ohm meter and your digital voltmeter or your volt ohm milliammeter can allow you to confirm with various testing techniques how good a ground that is. And 99% of the time, the girders of the building, the pipes of the building, the sewer system and the vents of the building are a hell of a lot better ground, a lot smaller number of milliohms to Mother Earth than that piece of wire you run down the side. So you probably don't need to do that. It probably will not gain you an awful lot if you did. And there's a slim chance that the supervisor...
Repeater, time out.
There's a slim chance that the supervisor of the building will be unhappy if you do it, because if he knows about it, he may think it's an unsightly thing that you've added to the top of the building 10 floors up, if you know what I mean, Joe. That's a bunch of opinions. Don't be afraid to check with other people as to what they think on this particular subject. AC2, Alpha Echo, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
I think, actually there is a girder, a very big one up there, and it's already got holes, like, drilled in it, and, believe it or not, the cable company is attached to that, and that's what I'm actually attached to up there right now. I attached it to them, and, that's what I've been using for a ground up there, but, definitely, gonna have to make, my radio link and, put some radios up there. Like I said, the antenna is already constructed. It's just that the radio plate is what's giving me a problem up there. And but now, I definitely, with your advice, definitely know what I'm going to do. And I say thank you for that. Yep, this net is definitely good. A friend of mine recommended me to this UJL, and it definitely gave me a lot of information. I'm going to definitely still stand by over here. I don't want to tie things up too much. AC2, AC.
Very fine, Joe. When it comes to using the same ground as the cable company, if it happens to be something like a Fios cable, fiber optics, no sweat. If it's real coaxial 70-ohm cable, RG6-like cable, and you're using that local ground and your antenna is very near their connection, be a little bit wary. If your wiring and your antenna location is very close to their wiring, like only feet away from it, and using a common ground, there's a slim possibility that your antenna inadvertently can launch some RF signal into their cable system, in which case some of the cable company customers in the building might get some extra interference from you. So be a little bit careful about that. If you could locate your antenna a little bit further away from their hardware, it would be to your advantage. Try to use the inverse square law in your favor. What I mean by the inverse square law is that if I had a field strength meter in my hand and I stood in front of your antenna while you transmit, I'm going to pick up a certain amount of pretty strong signal. If I double the distance between me and your antenna, inverse square law means that every time I double the distance, I get one quarter the amount of power into my field strength antenna. And if I double it again, the distance, I'll get one quarter of that, or 1/16th the power. So if you place distance between you and that cable company wiring, you'll drastically decrease the amount of signal you couple into it, and that could be to your advantage. When you do turn on your transmitter, if you're a cable company customer, make sure you look at each one of your television channels, make sure you're not interfering on your particular set, in which case that's an extremely good test to do. If you see any interference on any channel, when you're looking at the cable company system, when your transmitter is on the air, worry about that a little bit. It'd be nice for you to catch it first before the neighbors come pounding on your door telling you that they don't like what you're doing. It'd be nice for you to find out ahead of time and start taking corrective action. So I think you see where I'm going here, Joe. Let me pass it back to you for any further comments. AC2AE, K2RIW.
Yeah, I definitely will take that into consideration. I've already made an air choke. I'm waiting, like I said, I'm waiting on a toroid now and a couple of ferrites. So, like I said, it's going to be a test all the way, you know. If it even works, I'll be happy at all. But definitely, I do think that the television and the radio in the house and other equipment like that, if I was going to need it again. I actually do have a field strength meter, and I will be hopefully testing that. I am going to also be writing a little report on it, and hopefully it will work, you know, give us like a monthly report on what's going on with it and my contacts and all that. So hopefully all will go well. Back to you, then.
Very fine, Joe. I checked back with Mel and Dick, the two guys who run this neck, over the next few weeks. Let us know how your project is going, because you're a, I think, relatively new hand setting up a new installation, and your situation is rather similar to a number of other people who are listening. And so even if what you're doing doesn't work well at first, come back and let us know. We can make suggestions, and we'd like to ride along with you on this project, if you know what I mean. Let's see now. The last we heard from John last night, last weekend, Kilo Delta 2 Bravo Delta. John told us how he is capable of making a couple of parts per billion, as I remember, frequency accuracy measurements. He told us about his website you can go to, in which you look at the actual hardware, look at the schematic diagrams, and he told us how he's doing it. He's into a very fancy science. I mean, as you can tell, there are ham radio operators who really like to get into the high technology areas like extreme frequency accuracy. Let me drop. You probably know that the cesium beam standards used by what used to be called National Bureau of Standards, it's now NIST, National Institute of Standards and Technology, in Boulder, Colorado. It turns out of all the things that mankind measures, the thing that mankind measures with the greatest accuracy, in my opinion, is frequency or 1 over time. They're very related. And the National Bureau of Standards seems to measure frequency about 1 part in 10 to the 14. In other words, 14 decimal places of accuracy. They keep track of their standard, let's call it a 10 megacycle reference oscillator. And by various means of listening to the WWV or WWVB signals and their various derivatives through the broadcast industry and the cellular telephone, turns out the individual local reference oscillator that's associated with each individual cell phone base station requires extremely high accuracy in order for the cell phone base station to work very well. So step by step, there's all kinds of ways where you can listen to the chromatin signal of a network-affiliated broadcast signal, particularly one from a satellite. There are various other ways of listening to signals over the air and eventually make your local reference extremely accurate. And it turns out that John has been doing that as a hobby. The American Radio Relay League periodically holds a frequency accuracy measurement test. John has participated in a number of those, and as I get the impression, he has won awards doing that. And by way of his website, you can find out how he did it, and you can join him in that effort if that's what excites you. A good buddy of mine, who used to live in Connecticut, was using his, he was using his TVRO, Television Receive Only Terminal. That's one of those 10-foot dishes. He was listening to geosynchronous satellites that are doing broadcasts of television signals, mostly for the network linking, and he was measuring the frequency accuracy of those individual frequencies and the components of those television signals to find out which broadcast stations were high, low, and how much, and whether or not the satellite was moving and giving him Doppler shift. One of the things that I did that was kind of fun when I was listening to the Apollo astronauts on Apollo 15 and 16, while they were going around the moon, while the satellite in lunar orbit was going around the moon, the command service module, they went around the moon in a clockwise direction when viewed top view. Therefore, just before they disappeared behind the left-hand side of the moon, I could measure the frequency that they were transmitting, and I would see it quite negative. When they reappeared at acquisition of signal as they came out from behind the moon on the right-hand side and they were approaching me, I would see a significant amount of increase in their frequency. When you plotted their frequency versus time, you saw a characteristic S-curve of frequency versus time, which let you know where they were in their orbit around the moon, how fast they were moving, when they were going to go behind the moon. There's a lot of hidden information in measuring exact frequency accuracy and Doppler shift and whatever. I'll bet you John has gotten into Doppler shift measurements. Yes, he has. In the case of the ionosphere, which is reflecting the signal between Boulder, Colorado, and his home QTH on Long Island. I think he's living on Long Island, or is it in New Jersey? I'll look him up again. Anyhow, that ionosphere is not a completely steady, non-moving medium. The signal has to bounce up to the ionosphere and back down the ground a number of times to get between Boulder and his house. And depending on whether that ionosphere is ascending or descending, he gets a total path length that increases or decreases. And when he measures the frequency that he gets from the National Bureau of Standards, compares it against his local reference, he can see those motions. There's a lot of hidden information in what's called phase metering.
Repeater, time out.
Phase metering of a signal that you're receiving. I'm probably taking some of the wind out of your sail about what you'd like to be telling us tonight, John. And hopefully your signal's a little bit stronger than last week. And I know you're under the disadvantage of a slight null in the antenna pattern from this repeater in your direction because of the Frenchtown repeater. Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta, anything you want to tell us, go right ahead and throw it open to questions from the group if you want to. You got it, John, K2RIW and the TechNet.
K2RIW and the TechNet from Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta. Good evening, Dick. My presence here was just basically to answer any questions that you might have. I did participate in Wednesday night's frequency measurement test conducted by Connie Marshall, K5, Charlie Mike, who incidentally remembers you from some Central States VHF conferences years back. I did pretty well. The signals that I was copying from K5CM were nice and steady. I estimated that the multipath on the signals that I was receiving were fairly low based on the type of fading I was seeing. I took two 100-second readings, and I averaged them out, which is a little bit of a mistake. And my average reading was 5.31 times 10 to the negative 9th parts, a little bit too high, so about 5 parts per billion high, 19 millihertz high. So I took two readings. If I had stuck with my first reading, I would have been a little bit better, slightly better. But as it turned out, out of 31 participants, I ranked 4 from the top of the list with the fourth most accurate reading, which is pretty good considering, you know, it's over 1,000 miles of distance. So, any questions or anything, Dick? K2RAW and the TechNet from KD2BD.
Now, my first question is, what did you do since last week, John? Your signal is a tremendous lot stronger, both on the input and through the machine. First question there, John, go ahead.
I did absolutely nothing. This is all Mother Nature's fault. I'm noticing a much stronger signal on the repeater, and I'm hearing you on the input as well. Last week was the signal was quite weak, so this is just tropospheric conditions. K2REW from KD2BD.
I should know this. You live in Seagirt, New Jersey. Seagirt is roughly how many miles to the Nassau-Queens border where this repeater is located on so-called... all of a sudden I forgot the name of the town where the repeater is, but it's on the Nassau-Suffolk border. Glen Oaks. Glen Oaks is the name of the town unofficially. So roughly how many miles to Glen Oaks do you think there is to Seagirt? John, go ahead.
I think it's on the order of about 46 miles. And this path is a double horizon diffraction dominant path, according to the Longley-Rice propagation model. And I'm horizontally polarized. So, you know, what else could I do wrong to make my signal weaker? But I am running about 75 watts, and I have an 8-element Yagi up about 25 feet. So that helps a little bit. K2REW from KD2BD.
Yeah, one of the experiments you can do that'll be a lot of fun, John, when you're using a horizontally polarized Yagi, and I've done that. I've used from time to time a 305-element horizontally polarized array of 16 Yagis on 432 megacycles. This is a 3,500 cubic foot antenna mounted on the top of my 100-foot tower when that array was there. It's on my QSL card. Was the QSL card in the TQ magazine? I don't think it was. March or April, I guess it is, issue of 2008, issue of CQ Ham Radio, has an article about me and my antenna that I used on 432. When I aimed that antenna toward a 440 megacycle repeater, the repeater would not give me the strongest signal at the antenna's foresight. When you're cross-polarized, the peaks and valleys of the antenna pattern with cross-polarization fall in funny places. So if by some means you can listen to what's coming back from this repeater while you take your horizontally polarized antenna and aim it back and forth, you'll find there are some very sharp, desirable aiming positions for the antenna, which will give you the strongest signal. Technically speaking, those are called Condon lobes, because Mr. Condon wrote an article about this in the Radiation Laboratory series of McGraw-Hill book in 1948, the so-called Rad Lab series. In other words, the Radiation Laboratory did an awful lot of very advanced work on radars during World War II. At the end of that war, around 1948, they published a series of articles. And in book number 11 by Silver on microwave antennas, you go to the appropriate chapter and you'll see a footnote by Mr. Condon about these funny lobes you get in the antenna pattern when you're cross-polarized. But and you got to be careful, too. When you aim the horizontally polarized antenna back and forth and you're listening to the repeater on 146.85, that is not the exact same positions of the antenna where the strongest signal goes from you to the repeater on 146.25. Therefore, you've got to listen to what comes back while you're transmitting to find out which one of those Condon lobes of your cross-polarized antenna pattern will give you the repeater.
Time out.
Which one of those Condon lobes will give you the best performance. So that's another interesting science experiment. And it will change from day to day, because cross-polarization will give you local reflections from buildings and water towers and trees and ground and whatever, and the environment is always slightly chiral. Chirality really means the study of circular polarization characteristics. You can launch a purely horizontal signal from your antenna. After it bounces off the environment, a certain amount of vertical polarization exists in various three-dimensional angles, and it's part of this Condon lobe jazz. One of the interesting experiments anybody can do is to take an ordinary hand mirror, lay it on the table when somebody is across the table from you. You look at the reflection in the mirror of the person across the table from you, and you'll see them in the mirror upside down. That's a given. Hold the mirror out to your far left-hand side and look at the person's reflection, and you'll see them reversed left to right in the mirror. Now go halfway between the two. In other words, hold the mirror down to your left, but position it in such a way that you see the person in front of you. You're to the left of when it was directly on the table in front of you, but you're down further than you would be when it's purely to the left. So you arrange the mirror to the lower left so that now you're halfway between those two extremes. The image that you see of the person will be horizontal, even though they are vertical. You have found a position that gives a kind of depolarization of a certain kind. Well, the environment does that from time to time. That's also another one of the funny phenomena of the so-called condom lobe thing. So you've chosen a good position, and then the 40-some-odd miles between Seagirt and Glen Oak, looks like Mother Nature is supporting us with some very nice propagation tonight. And you mentioned the kind of propagation. When you're listening to that signal on WVB, I guess it is, I presume it's a kind of D-layer or E-layer ionospheric reflection, absorption, refraction, whatever. You might mention what you think. What's the maximum Doppler shift you've ever seen on the WWVB signal that you use for adjusting your reference? I do remember asking you last week, what is the amount of integration time constant? I think you only used a couple of minutes, a very short time constant. And I know that part of what's going on there is you've got to have a stable servo mechanism. In other words, the lead lag network or the equivalent that does the adjustment of the voltage that goes into your voltage-controlled oscillator, your VCXO, that is your local 10-megacycle reference. I'm guessing it's a 10-megacycle reference. That's one of the very popular numbers that are used, at least by Hewlett-Packard equipment. I think I had a question in there. I think I had a couple of comments you might want to address. So what kind of Doppler shift have you seen on WWV and WWVB? Connie Mack, I think his name is, in Muskogee, Oklahoma, I think it is. So Connie Marshall. Yes, I have met him at past meetings decades ago when I used to go to the Central States VHF Society, and they presented an award to me once because of the work that I did with the parallel kilowatt amplifier, strip line amplifier for 432, and the 12-foot dish work and the listen to the Apollo astronauts. They gave me an award. All of a sudden, I can't think of the name of it. It'll come to me in a few minutes. And I think Connie was present during one of those meetings. And a good group of guys, the Central States group. So, comment on any of the above as I see it, John. KD2BD, fascinating. And too bad you didn't come in number one this time, but it's going to give you a little bit more challenge. KD2BD, K2RIW.
K2RIW and the TechNet from KD2BD. Boy, lots of interesting things to talk about there. I did at one point try to conduct some experiments to figure out or measure how much Doppler shift I'm seeing on WWVB's carrier at 60 kilohertz, since that's what I'm using as a reference for my frequency standard. And my method for doing so was to measure radio station WSAN's carrier at 660 kilohertz, because it's based on the measurements that I've made of their carrier frequency, it seems like it's right on 660 kilohertz. And my belief is that they're running a rubidium oscillator in their exciter, and it's controlled under a GPS receiver. Well, I did that one evening, and I wanted to conduct this experiment from about an hour or so before our local sunset to at least an hour after Boulder, Colorado's sunset. And what happened was I was collecting my data, and a little while after sunset in Boulder, the frequency shifted by over, I think, 1.2 hertz or something like that. And I came to the realization that the radio station either switched exciters or switched transmitters at that time. It was after sunset, and they were running IBOC, the digital modulation for a digital radio. And sometimes the stations that run IBOC turn that exciter or that feature off after sunset, not to interfere with other stations on adjacent frequencies halfway around the country. So That experiment didn't go very well. I might have to try doing that again. But I did see about a 15 part per billion rise in my standards frequency. So that was perfectly legitimate, perfectly plausible, because I would expect the frequency to rise slightly after sunset because the ionosphere was rising at that time. Let me drop it for a second. Okay. I'm pretty sure the propagation at 60 kilohertz is primarily ground wave closer into the transmitter, and I think where we are in on the East Coast, it's a combination of ground wave and D-layer propagation. If you look at any of the NBS publications where they show coverage maps, predicted contours of WWDB coverage, either now or even in the past when they ran a lower power and a different antenna situation, you notice that the signal strength that they predict on the east coast of the United States is pretty close to what they predict on the west coast of the United States, and yet the transmitter is out near Fort Collins, Colorado. How could this be? Is it a directional pattern of the antenna system? Is it ground conductivity? Is it maybe the mountainous terrain in Colorado? I don't think it's any of those things. I think it's one-way propagation. I read, and I think it was in the radio, the Reference Data for Radio Engineers manual. And by the way, getting information on LF propagation is kind of tough. But I think there's a sentence in that book that mentions something about propagation from west to east having lower loss than propagation going from east to west. And so it's my belief that effect is a one-way propagation effect. As far as polarization here on 2 meters, there was a time when I had a ground plane antenna in the attic, almost directly below the current horizontal Yagi that I'm using, and I would switch back and forth between those two antennas. The horizontal Yagi always gave me a stronger signal, but the difference in signal strength between each antenna would change. It would change, especially around the time of sunset, and the hours after sunset, and the warmer months, because most of this task that I'm working the repeater on, by the way, is over the Atlantic Ocean. And so that, to me, seems to indicate that the polarization is probably twisting a little bit, or being tilted a little bit, to tropospheric effects. Because otherwise, I would expect that the two antennas would track, in a parallel fashion with signal strength. So back to you, K2RAW and the TechNet from KD2BD.
Comments at K2KEY.
No recognized. I got a quick question for you, John, and that is a number of commercial organizations who need reasonably high frequency accuracy establish an in-house standard, which is a reference oscillator, rubidium or cesium, usually rubidium, because it's a little less expensive and a little bit higher in spectral purity, and they discipline that oscillator by way of a global positioning satellite receiver system. The GPS satellites have an extreme accuracy oscillator on board, and there's a constellation of 24 of those satellites flying over your house almost every day, so to speak. So by choosing the right combination of those satellites and listening to their reference oscillator, you get an extremely good local reference oscillator in your place of business. You've been telling me you're using WWVB 60 kilohertz, and I wonder why you have chosen not to use GPS. A quick break on that one, John, before we go over to Mel. KD2BD, K2RIW.
K2RIW and the TechNet from KD2BD. Kind of a funny answer, because it's RF. It's total radio. I've always been fascinated with the LF propagation and LF radio, and about 6 years ago, I was conducting some experiments to see if I can copy WWVB's carrier using a loop antenna and a preamp, and I found the signal, and I said, wow, this is kind of neat, wonder what I can do with it. And slowly but surely I built up a receiver, phase lock looped receiver with the 10 megahertz reference, by the way. Starts off with a 10 megahertz crystal oscillator, and so I never went the GPS route, at least not up to this point. Another comment about polarization, because Mel's question last week about how accurate do I see WWVB's signal? Well, if you went to that webpage where I describe my frequency measurement setup, shows, which plots measurement of CHU's carrier as a function of time, but using two separate antennas, a vertical antenna and a horizontal antenna. And I actually measure different frequencies depending on whether I'm using whether I'm receiving with a horizontal antenna or vertical antenna. How about that? K2REW in the TechNet from KD2BD.
It turns out that one-way propagation or non-reciprocity of propagation is something very prevalent in the ionosphere, and people don't realize that. The ionosphere is a kind of a plasma. Plasma means that there are positive and negatively charged particles. In other words, the ionospheric material has been made up of molecules where cosmic rays and solar radiation, whatever, has made some of those electrons break away from the nucleus of some of those atoms, and therefore you've got slightly positively charged nucleuses and negatively charged electron cloud floating around. That's the ionosphere, and it's got a Earth's magnetic field mixed into it. Whenever you've got a plasma simultaneous with a magnetic field, a signal that propagates from east to west and west to east will not behave the same in signal strength and in polarization. The Faraday rotation characteristic from east to west and west to east does not obey reciprocity. You'd like to think that if the signal got twisted 45 degrees in polarization in going from east to west, that it would twist negative 45 degrees in going from west to east. Doesn't do that. And so these are some of the effects I think you're seeing. Mel's got some questions or comments. K2KEY, K2RIW.
I just exactly had that experience last night. I got home last night about 1 o'clock in the morning, and I figured I was going to sit down and relax a little bit, just unwind. And so I tuned around the bands, and everything was just about gone. There was nothing really. I listened to 160 dead. 80 meters, well, I tried 40 meters, and I thought maybe it would be some signals on 40, but it was just about dead. On 80, I picked up a weak signal, down on the low end on CW, from ZS1JX in South Africa. And I was listening to him with my vertical antenna, which usually is a good antenna for DXing, the low angle takeoff, that 65 foot, 80 meter vertical. And I switched to the horizontal loop, and sure enough, his signal came up surprisingly on the horizontal loop. So when he finished talking to the station in Scotland, I called him, came back to me, and I did a little experiment. He was hearing me better on the vertical, but I was hearing him better on the horizontal, Dick, over.
Doesn't surprise me at all. And so many of us have experienced QSB fading when listening to HF signals, and we think the signal is skipping over us or skipping under us. In some cases, it is just cross-polarized with your particular antenna. The signal wanders through vertical polarization when you're using a horizontal dipole, or vice versa. And if you had the ability to switch over to another antenna on your property of the opposite polarization, and even listen clockwise and counterclockwise, you'll see some very interesting effects. That's what I think some of what John is bringing to our attention. I just did a quick, simple mathematical definition here, John, and division. You're listening to WWV at 60 kilohertz, and your local reference oscillator is 10 megacycles. The ratio between the two is 166.66666. It's a continuing decimal. And I can see why you don't use very simple division or multiplication in order to set up your phase lock loop. You've got an offset oscillator of 1 KC, if I remember the schematic I saw last week, and this is part of the reason you did things like that, so as not to do a fractional divide circuit. Oh, then again, fractional divide circuits, a so-called swallow counter, can also do a very nice job. These kinds of phase lock loops nowadays that have a reference, an R, an X, and an A, as I remember. They've got 3 different things that you set up in the phase lock loop chip, and it's called a swallow counter in order to get these crazy offset numbers. KD2BD, for any comments on all of the above? K2RIW in the TechNet.
One more comment, Dick.
Go ahead, Mel.
Yeah, I also noticed that also. there was a slight shift in his frequency when I went from one antenna system to the other. This is the only thing I've observed a number of times, that under certain conditions you get that effect. In other words, if I switch the antennas from the vertical to the horizontal, I can hear not only the signal strength change, but I can hear a slight shift in the frequency of the signal. I've had that experience a number of times. So it shows you, really, you really said the right thing, that unfortunately you need more than one antenna per band at times, because it seems like what you would think would be the ideal antenna. And he was, oh, by the way, he was vertically polarized there in South Africa, so I was really surprised to be able to be receiving him so much better on the loop, but it shows you how much twist there was in the signal over.
Okay, yeah, Mel, the fact that he transmitted vertical and you heard him horizontal strongest, that doesn't give me any grief. I can accept that one beautifully. Where you see the vertically polarized signal or the horizontally polarized signal are on a different frequency continuously, I'm a little troubled by that one. I can see a moving ionosphere doing that, but still there is the possibility that you're hearing other tones in the background, other heterodyning signals, and when you go from horizontal to vertical, you're listening to a different combination of those tones. I mean, one of those tones gets stronger, another tone gets weaker, therefore you hear a different pitch of these tones in the background, which could lead you to believe that he, the guy you're listening to, is on a new frequency. So there's a slim possibility that what you heard sounded like a new frequency, but maybe it wasn't. So I wonder if you can pin down for me, Mel, what you believe was a difference in frequency. Was there 15 hertz difference, so to speak, whereas to make his voice on sideband sound right, you had to retune the receiver by one click of its phase lock loop. My particular phase lock loop in this radio, for instance, moved in 10 hertz steps. This is a TS711A 2-meter all-mode rig, and it's got a synthesizer that moves in 10 hertz steps. And maybe you know what the step sizes of your particular rig. And I presume you were listening to them on 14 megacycles, or maybe it was 40 megacycles. K2REW. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay. The frequency he was operating on was exactly 3508 on 80 meters CW. This is CW. And I could tell that when I changed the antennas, that I could hear the change in the tone of the CW signal. In fact, I could see a little bit on it. I could see, I was looking at the scope, and I could see a little bit of a spike shift on this CW pitch that was coming through. So the only thing I can account for is that it has to be something that's shifting slightly in frequency, because otherwise I can't account for the change in the pitch of the CW tone, Dick. That's why I think that there is something a little different, because the peculiar conditions that sometimes exist, this is an unusual condition. You don't always hear this type of effect, Dick. In fact, he was the only signal, the only two signals on the entire band that I could hear was this guy in South Africa and the one he was talking to. Funny, I heard him in Scotland. I later worked with him. When I finished with him, he was up about 3-4 kilohertz up calling CQ. Nobody came back to him, so I came back to him and I told the situation. And we did the same test again, and he couldn't see any difference now between my horizontal and my vertical antenna in Scotland. Over.
Your horizontal antenna is the loop, and the vertical is the green piece of wire out front in the tree. Is that true, Mel? Go ahead.
Well, the vertical antenna is the one with the 100 radials buried, and the horizontal loop is the one that's, 275 feet of loop that goes around the entire property. Over.
Very good. So, the question I got for you, John, is have you seen a frequency shift on any of the signals you've listened to on LF frequencies or HF frequencies when you go from horizontal to vertical polarization? To see a phase shift when you do that, I accept. To see see a continuous frequency shift over, let's say, the next 10 minutes, where you're accumulating phase. That's what you really do when you got a frequency shift. To account for that difference in horizontal versus vertical polarization,